Good morning. It's good to see everyone here this morning, especially those of you who are visiting with us. I'd like to add my word of welcome and let you know that you are our honored guest, and we are pleased that you could take this time this morning and be with the Lord's people on the first day of the week as we come together to encourage one another and to worship our God. Thankful that you are here, and as Will said, please stick around that we might get a chance to get to know you a little bit after services. Over the past few months, when I have brought lessons on Sunday mornings, we have been engaged in a study of evidences for our faith. And kind of going back and recapping those lessons real quickly, we began with some evidence of early Bible accounts in the written Chinese language hundreds of years even before the scriptures were written down. We see evidence of those stories, those accounts in the Chinese language that point to, again, the universality of these stories and the fact that perhaps those people were there at the time of those stories but when those things actually took place. Then we began by asking the question, is it reasonable to even believe in a God at all? In this age of scientific discovery, in this age of of humanism, in this age in which we have doubts and consider anything religious as superstitious, is there really evidence that supports the idea of a God at all? Or have we moved beyond that as humanity? Well, and we looked at the evidence of a designer based on the highly complex design of creation itself, the intelligent design within and around us that points to an intelligent designer. Then we looked a little bit at the Bible and specifically the New Testament and questioned whether or not it is reliable for us. Do we have what was actually written down thousands of years ago, or has it been corrupted? Has it changed over the centuries as people have written it and rewritten it and recopied it? And what we discovered when we looked at the evidence was that the Bible is the most well-attested to ancient document in existence, and it's not even close when we look at the attestation of the accuracy of the Bible. Thousands of documents that go back to within fairly recent time frames or early time frames within the writings of the scriptures, and the reliability of those documents and the consistency between those documents is incredible. And so then we ask the question, well, why the Bible? There are a lot of religious writings out there, a lot of people making claims about having a way to God. Why in the world would we believe the Bible over any of those other documents? And so we examine the qualities and the characteristics of the Bible that show it is unique among all religious writings and that it could only have come from God and not simply from man. And so today we want to conclude this series on evidences by looking at the evidence for the most important event in human history. The Christian faith is the only religion based upon a provable historical event witnessed by more than 500 people in which God showed forth His power, and not simply upon one man's personal experience or personal religious experience. Yet there are many skeptics when it comes to the resurrection of Christ. Many claim that it can't even be proven that Christ existed, much less that He died and was raised from the dead. Now, Paul did not ask the Christians at Corinth to close their eyes, shut off their brains, and take a blind leap of faith. In 1 Corinthians 15, when Paul tells us that the birth, death, and resurrection of Christ is the foundation of the gospel, he made it clear to point out that there were over 500 people who had witnessed the risen Christ. And he said, many of whom are still alive today, pointing out to them that if you don't believe me, there are hundreds of witnesses out there that you can go and check this out. It pointed to a provable, verifiable historic event and logically showed how that event showed forth the power of God. In Romans chapter 1, Paul tells us that Jesus was shown to be the Christ by the power of the resurrection. And so he pointed to those prophets who had foretold of this event. And he appointed and he pointed to those witnesses of the resurrected Christ. And so the question is, are these witnesses reliable? Can we know today that Jesus lived and died and was raised from the dead? And so this morning I want us to look at some evidences of the resurrection. What do we know? What can we point to? What can we see that gives us evidence that the resurrection really took place? And of course, to begin with, we must know that Jesus lived and died. If Jesus never existed, if Jesus never walked this earth, if Jesus was simply someone that was made up, then the resurrection is a hoax. And so we need to first see if there's enough evidence to show that Jesus lived and died. And we want to begin with the biblical record. The biblical record. And we begin there, of course, because that is the most complete record of Jesus' life and death. When we go to the Bible, we can go back to the Old Testament and see that there were numerous prophecies that pointed to someone coming, that God was sending someone. And these prophecies pointed to someone who would come to save God's people. There were over 300 of those prophecies in the Old Testament. And Jesus fulfilled those prophecies. Now, you all have probably heard the different reasons that people reject that. They may say that, well, he was manipulated, his life was manipulated in such a way that he fulfilled these prophecies. But some of the prophecies were about things that he couldn't possibly have manipulated. Prophecies about where he would be born. Prophecies about how people would react to him. Prophecies about how he would die. Those are things that he couldn't possibly have manipulated. Or you could say, well, it was just coincidence that he fulfilled these prophecies. They found somebody who fulfilled these things, and it was mere coincidence. But again, you've all probably heard the illustration that's given about Jesus fulfilling these prophecies by coincidence. Again, if you took it just simply 8 of those prophecies from the Old Testament and said Jesus fulfilled those 8 by coincidence, the numbers are astronomical that he would have fulfilled them. Any one man would have fulfilled them simply coincidentally. The illustration that's given is if you take quarters and covered the state of Texas 2 feet deep in quarters and took one quarter and put a mark on that quarter and put it in that mix somewhere in the state of Texas, and sent somebody out to find that quarter blindfolded, the chances of them finding that one quarter in one try are the same chances of Jesus accidentally or coincidentally fulfilling simply 8 of those prophecies. As I mentioned before, there are over 300 prophecies pointing to Jesus that he fulfilled from the Old Testament. Then when you look at the New Testament, there are at least 8 different writers who based their writings on specifically on the life and death of Christ. And when we look at the Gospels themselves, we have 4 independent sources that report on the life, specifically the life of Jesus. And then you throw in Paul, who also told us a lot about his life. So we have 4 Gospel writers, and again, there are arguments against the Gospels being accurate. And a couple of those arguments are, first, that there was collusion, that people got together after Jesus died, they made up these stories, they made up these fables about this man, and they wrote these things down. Well, now, if you were to read the 4 Gospels and they all said exactly the same thing, then you might think, well, there's collusion. Bill, if 3 or 4 witnesses get up on the stand in a trial and they all say the exact same thing, what's your conclusion going to be? They planned it. They talked to one another. They had a script. That's collusion. But if you have 3 witnesses get up on the stand and they say essentially the same thing, but some of their details are different or some of the things that they remember are a little bit different, then you can say that there's a kernel, a nugget of truth in there that we can believe. And when we look at the Scriptures, the 4 Gospels, that's what we see. Is we see 4 men writing from 4 different perspectives to 4 different audiences who were witnesses to these events. So then the other side of that coin is they say, well, these Gospels contradict themselves. You have different versions that say different things about the same events. They can't be the same, talking about the same thing, or they're making this up, they're lying about it. And a lot of them point to the resurrection appearances of Jesus in the Gospels. Well, in Matthew, we've got Mary Magdalene and the other Mary. In Mark, you have Mary Magdalene, the other Mary, and Salome. And in Luke, you've got Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary, and other women. And then in John, all you have is Mary Magdalene. So clearly, they can't even get their facts straight. They don't know who was there at the tomb. 2 weeks ago on Tuesday night, we played volleyball at the Aaron's house. And if I could remember, my memory's not that good, I could tell you who was on my team. And I may tell you a story about that night and about my team and who was there. Stacy was on a different team, and she may tell you a story about Tuesday night 2 weeks ago and tell you the people that were on her team. Well, clearly we both couldn't have been there because she had a completely different list of people who were there than I had who were there, right? Well, of course not. We both witnessed the same event, but I was telling it from the perspective of my team. She was telling it from the perspective of her team. We both witnessed the same events. So just because they don't tell the same people in the same place at the same time doesn't mean that they're contradictions. They're telling it from a different perspective for different reasons. And so we have these sources that are reliable that tell us about the life and death of Jesus. But secondly, we have some sources that are outside of the Bible. We have sources from outside of the Bible that do not have any interest in telling this particular story that mention Jesus and his existence. Tacitus is a Roman historian writing about AD 115, talking about Christians and their odd habits of meeting together. And he said their originator, this is a quote from Tacitus, their originator, Christ, had been executed in Tiberius's reign by the governor of Judea, Pontius Pilate. And so here we have a non-biblical source pointing to Jesus and telling us some of the facts that are related to us in the Scriptures. Josephus, a Jewish historian who lived from about AD 37 to about AD 100, wrote several histories of the Jews. He wrote about the Jewish wars, about the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. But his longer work is the Antiquity of the Jews. And in this writing, he had a quote that talks about Jesus. Now, there are some probably additions to this quote that we can see may have been added in later. But again, the quote is talking about Jesus. Now, there was, about this time, Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man, for he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as received the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was the Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men amongst us, had condemned him to the cross, those who loved him at first did not forsake him. And so we have Josephus, a Jewish historian, recording the fact that Jesus lived and that he was put to death during Pilate's reign. A later series of writings, the Jewish Talmud, which was completed around AD 200. Again, these are the writings of the Jewish rabbis interpreting Scripture, talking about the way Scripture is applied. And they have a quote that says, Jesus of Nazareth was a transgressor in Israel who practiced magic, scorned the words of the wise, led the people astray, and said that he had not come to destroy the law, but to add to it. He was hanged on Passover Eve for heresy and misleading the people. And so when you run across those who argue that Jesus never lived, Jesus was simply a figment of people's imagination, it's not being honest. Because we have some pretty clear evidence that Jesus lived and died. But that doesn't mean he was raised from the dead, does it? That doesn't indicate anything about his resurrection. It simply means that a man named Jesus walked the earth, and we have historical documents that reflect that. So what evidence do we have of the resurrection? One of the most compelling evidences is, of course, the fact that the tomb was empty. And so again, we want to look at the biblical record because that's where we get our closest and our most detailed accounts of the resurrection and the fact that the tomb was empty. And one of the things that we see in the Gospels, and it's common to all of the Gospels, is that the tomb was provided by Joseph of Arimathea. Backing up in Matthew, the Gospel of Matthew, we see that, that Joseph of Arimathea provided the tomb for Jesus. Now when evening had come, verse 57 of chapter 27, now when evening had come, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who himself had also become a disciple of Jesus. This man went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Then Pilate commanded the body to be given to him. And when Joseph had taken the body, he wrapped it in a clean linen cloth and laid it in his new tomb, which he had hewn out of the rock. And he rolled a stone, a large stone, against the door of the tomb and departed. That's interesting. There aren't many details in the Scriptures that are given in all four Gospels. But this is one of them. All four of the Gospels mention Joseph of Arimathea. And that's powerful evidence of at least the fact that there was a tomb and that we know where that tomb was. Here was a specific man, a Jew, who had come to believe in Jesus, a specific man of a specific group of people that was verifiable. That people could have gone to Joseph at the time these stories were beginning to surface and say, "Is this true? Did you have a tomb? Did you provide this tomb for Jesus to be buried in?" It's pretty compelling evidence of the tomb. But the second piece of compelling evidence of the tomb being empty is that the guards were paid off to lie about the tomb and the reason for the tomb being empty. The penalty for a guard for losing their prisoner, and even a dead body was considered a prisoner, was death. In Acts chapter 12, when Peter was thrown into prison, we read of the miraculous earthquake that released him from prison. And in Acts chapter 12 and verse 19, it says, "But when Herod had searched for him and had not found him, Peter, he examined the guards and commanded that they should be put to death." That was standard practice. If you lose your prisoner, or if you lose the one you're guarding, you would lose your life for their life. And so these guards who had been guarding the tomb were paid to lie and say that the disciples had come and stolen away the body. Now, if you knew you were going to lose your life over losing that body, if that body were still in the tomb, wouldn't you take somebody and show them? Would you take a bribe to say that the body was gone? Absolutely not. And so the fact that they were willing to take a bribe to make up a story about why the tomb was empty is pretty good evidence that the tomb was empty. And of course, within 2 months of the resurrection, they began to proclaim in Jerusalem that Jesus had been raised from the dead. And part of that proclamation was the fact that the tomb is empty. Now, they don't say that directly, but Peter says it kind of indirectly when he quotes the prophecy of David, beginning in chapter 25 of Acts chapter 2, from the Psalms. He says, "I foresaw the Lord always before my face, for He's at my right hand that I may not be shaken. Therefore my heart rejoiced and my tongue was glad. Moreover, my flesh also will rest in hope, for You will not leave my soul in Hades, nor will You allow Your Holy One to see corruption. You have made known to me the ways of life. You will make me full of joy in Your presence." Peter goes on to comment on that verse by saying, "Men and brethren, let me speak freely to you of the patriarch David, that he is both dead and buried, and his tomb is with us to this day." And so what was Peter implying? If you want to see the bones of David, go to his tomb. They're still there. So David clearly was not speaking of himself. Therefore, verse 30, being a prophet and knowing that God had sworn with an oath to him that of the fruit of his body, according to the flesh, he would raise up Christ to sit on his throne, David, foreseeing this, spoke concerning the resurrection of the Christ, that his soul was not left in Hades, nor did his flesh see corruption. And so Peter was essentially challenging them to go to the tomb. David had this saying, had this quote, that you will not leave my soul in Hades, nor will you allow my Holy One to see corruption. And yet David's bones can be found. We know where his tomb is. So David wasn't speaking of himself. He was prophesying regarding the resurrection of Christ. You can go find the tomb and find it empty. And so there's pretty compelling evidence that the tomb was empty. But again, we have evidence outside of the Bible of the empty tomb. First century letter from a Jew that was quoted by Justin Martyr says a godless and lawless heresy had sprung up from one Jesus, a Galilean deceiver who was crucified. This is a Jew writing this letter. But his disciples stole him by night from the tomb where he was laid when he was unfastened from the cross, and now deceive men by asserting that he has risen from the dead and ascended to heaven. If they didn't have the problem of the empty tomb, why would they have to make up the story of the disciples stealing his body? So here in the first century, or early second century, the Jews were already making up stories. And in fact, that's exactly what Matthew said at the end of the passage that Mike read for us earlier. So they took the money and did as they were instructed, and that saying is commonly reported among the Jews to this day, that the disciples stole the body. And that's how we explain the empty tomb. But there's an even later passage from the 6th century. It's amazing, 500 years or so later, the Jews are still talking about this. From a writing called the Toledeth Yeshu, it says, a diligent search was made, and he, Jesus, was not found in the grave where he had been buried. We have another story. A gardener had taken him from the grave and had brought him to his garden and buried him in the sand over which the waters flowed into the garden. And so 500 years later, the Jews are still trying to explain why the tomb was empty, because they didn't want to believe the truth. So Jesus lived and Jesus died and the tomb was empty, but did he rise from the dead? Is that the best explanation of the empty tomb? And so let's take a look at some evidences for the resurrection. The first evidence is the historical accuracy of the Bible. When we look at the Bible and the Bible writers, the historical accuracy is amazing, especially when we look at Luke. Luke claimed to be a historian. When he wrote these things down, he said, I was writing them down according to what I witnessed, according to what we've heard. I'm writing them in a manner that makes sense. He was writing it for a patron, for Theophilus. He wrote nearly a third of the New Testament, because Luke wrote both Luke and Acts. His historical accuracy is scrutinized more than any other. In the book of Acts, Luke mentions 32 countries, 54 cities, 9 Mediterranean islands, 95 different people, 62 of whom are found nowhere else in the New Testament. And wherever these facts, wherever these references have been able to be verified, they have always been correct. Never once have we found a piece of archaeological evidence or a legal document of the time or other contemporary writers that contradict what Luke had said in the book of Acts. In fact, there's several places where people had thought, Luke got it wrong there, and then years later somebody would discover a document, Nope, Luke was right. And so the historical accuracy of the Bible gives us, again, some confidence when it talks about such things as the resurrection. The second resurrection evidence is, of course, the witnesses of the resurrected Christ. We referred to this passage earlier, 1 Corinthians 15, that great chapter in the Bible on the resurrection. And Paul says, beginning in verse 3, "For I deliver to you first of all that which I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, and that He was buried, and that He rose again the third day according to the Scriptures." So here Paul is appealing to the prophecies. This was foretold. These are things that you shouldn't have been surprised about, because these were foretold. And Jesus just did exactly what was foretold. "And that He was seen by Cephas," Peter, "then by the 12. After that, He was seen by over 500 brethren at once, of whom the greater part remain to the present, but some have fallen asleep. After that, He was seen by James, then by all of the apostles, then last of all, He was seen by me also as one born out of time." So we have hundreds of witnesses to the resurrected Christ. Hundreds of people who saw Christ after He had been killed and buried. Second key piece of evidence that helps convince us of the truth of the resurrection is that women were the first witnesses. Women were the first witnesses. Every gospel account, we see that women are the first ones at the tomb. And the significance of that is not minor. In the time of Jesus' life and death and the resurrection, women were not seen as valid witnesses. They could not go to court as witnesses against men. They could not go to court and be witnesses. They were not seen as reliable witnesses. And so if you were making up a story about somebody raising from the dead, that's a pretty amazing thing, right? If you were making up a story about somebody raising from the dead, the last thing you would do was have the witnesses be women. Now, that may be different in today's society, but then you wouldn't have done that. That would be kind of like us today saying 3-year-olds were the first witnesses. Well, are we going to believe that? No, not necessarily. And so the fact that women are reported as the first witnesses in all four of the Gospels is a pretty compelling evidence that this is the truth. This is the truth. And then, of course, going back to Acts chapter 2, this proclamation was based on eyewitness testimony. Based on eyewitness testimony. This God, this Jesus, God has raised up, of which we are all witnesses. We are all witnesses. And so, preaching in Jerusalem within a couple of months of these events taking place was based on eyewitness accounts in front of the very people who would have loved more than anything to prove them wrong. And it couldn't be done. A few more evidences. First off, the changed lives of the apostles. We all know what happened to the apostles when Jesus was arrested and taken off to trial. All the apostles were scattered. It had been prophesied, "Strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered." And the apostles did exactly as was prophesied. And after Jesus died, the apostles were gathered together, hiding, scared for their lives, because they were afraid they were next. But what happened after Jesus appeared to them? What happened in Acts chapter 2? As they stood up boldly in front of the people they knew who would want them dead and proclaimed that Jesus had been raised from the dead. You don't do that unless you are confident in what you're speaking about. Not only that, but the changed lives of skeptics. In Acts chapter 2, it tells us at least 3,000 Jews were converted that day. And I don't think we ever really fully understand the magnitude of that conversion. Jews have a history of a couple of thousand years, and they live their lives based on what they believed God had given them, and the practices that they did were based on the knowledge that God had given them those practices and had been passed down from generation to generation to generation. And within the first few months, probably as many as 10,000 Jews were converted. And so you're talking about 10,000 people who once believed that they had to live their law according to the law of Moses, saying we don't have to live that way anymore. Who once believed and saw the importance of keeping the Sabbath, and now said we don't have to do that anymore. Who once believed that they had to have sacrifices made for their sins, that they had to offer these bulls and goats and all of these things in the temple and had to do that once a year at the Day of Atonement, now say these things aren't necessary anymore. This is a radical shift in thousands, maybe tens of thousands of people on a dime. I just don't think we understand the magnitude of those skeptics changing that dramatically. And of course, we can look at some others. James, the brother of Jesus. In John chapter 7, we read that James, the brother of Jesus, and some of his other siblings kind of were goading Jesus, go on up to Jerusalem and show him your power. They didn't believe, John tells us. They didn't believe in Jesus. And we read later that James becomes a pillar of the church in Jerusalem. And of course, the Apostle Paul, who was consigning people to death, who were following after Jesus, and was changed by an appearance of the resurrected Christ. And of course, the last piece of evidence is the suffering and death of the apostles. And we've mentioned this before earlier when I talked about evidences a few months ago. Many people have died for things that they had faith in or believed in or thought to be true, but had no way of 100% proving that. As I said, the men who flew their planes into the towers on September 11th thought they were dying for their God. And they gave up their lives. But the apostles were in a position to know for a fact whether or not Jesus raised from the dead. If it were a big farce, if this were something they made up, they would have known that for a fact. And to think that 12 of 12, or really 13 of 13 including Paul, would go to their death without at least one of them going, whoa, wait a minute, we were kidding. Just kidding. That didn't really happen. Is incredible. Because they would have known. And yet they all, according to Scripture and to tradition, died for their faith. Christian faith is based upon an historical event. The death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. Do we have any eyewitnesses left today? Do we have anybody who wrote down what happened when Jesus came out of the tomb? Not exactly. But is there evidence that we can stack up that gives us confidence that Jesus lived and died and was buried and that tomb was empty on the third day? And no one has given us an explanation better than He was raised from the dead. We can put our faith in that. Because when we do, then we have secured our eternity. If you're here this morning and you have questions, come talk to us. We'll be glad to sit down and study the Scriptures with you, study some more things about evidences. But if you're convinced and you've not made the step, you need to answer for that. If you know who Jesus is and believe he's raised from the dead, then you have to ask yourself, what am I going to do about that? That's not just a fact that I can go, okay, I'm going to put that fact over here and it doesn't matter. I might make a statement like something about the country of Africa and it's a fact, but I don't have to do anything about it. It's on the other side of the world. But this I have to do something about. And so my question is, what's holding you back? If you're ready to make that commitment this morning, I encourage you to come forward as we stand and sing our hymn of invitation.